Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Hello, everyone. This is Ken McKean. Welcome you to Nature's Talk Show. Tonight's The Fine Art of Paleontology. My co-host Ken Borman and I will take you once again on another adventure back in time as we explore the mysteries and wonders of the Earth's past. But before we do that, Ken and I and Mary Fetters here at Nature's Talk Show wish to invite you to join in on our Nature's Talk Show live chat on our website. Go to www.naturestalkshow.com. Join in there. I believe Ken, as always, is there to field questions from our listeners, and we really appreciate you guys' questions, too, because it makes the show a lot of fun. And but before we get away on our subject here, because we're going to have a really cool subject, we're going to talk about a really interesting part of time back in the Carboniferous period here on the show tonight. So, but before we do that, Ken and I have some couple cool, interesting announcements to make. Ken, you're going to be at the Northeast Conference of Aquarium Societies here this coming month, aren't you?
Yes, I am, Ken. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah.
On the weekend of April the 8th to the 10th, we'll be at Rocky Hill, Connecticut for the Northeast Council of Aquarium Societies. It will be their 41st annual convention. So I've been doing it a long time, and as Ken knows, they know what they're doing, and it's a great weekend. So I ask all of our listeners, if you're in the area, drop by. Stay for the convention or just drop by and say hello to us. We'll be in the manufacturers and vendors room. Come in. If you have any suggestions, talk to us about them. Tom, Mary, and myself will be there. There's a great lineup of speakers. It's 14 speaker programs. There's plenty to choose from. Don't forget, too, we've got raffles. We'll be selling tickets in some of Ken's fantastic artworks. If you have a look on our website, naturestalkshow.com, down towards the about halfway down the page, you'll see flyers that were made for the convention, and you'll see the actual artwork that you can buy tickets in, very reasonably priced too. The tickets are only $2 each, or $3 for $5.
Yeah,
and well worth doing a little bit of investing there, get some of Ken's great art.
Yeah, it's a fun way to win a piece of artwork. You know, I've been doing artwork for over a quarter of a century, and it's been fun. It's fun. I'm still busy as ever. But you know, Ken, I was a couple years ago. I was a guest speaker at the NEC conference, and the people there are magnificent. They showed me an absolutely wonderful time. I made so many wonderful friends, and I met so many people that I knew on knew as friends on Facebook, and that was a lot of fun as well. And it was a blast being a guest speaker. I know you guys are going to have a lot of fun there, Ken. You guys are going to have a blast, and Leslie Dick, she's just a wonderful lady, and the rest of the crew as well. And
I'm really looking forward to it. Not the least, of course, it's for speaking to our listeners.
Mm-hmm. Now,
that'll be a blast.
Yeah. Now, I think it's getting about time we can start talking about this here as well, because it's coming up in just a few weeks, and that's your guys' show where I'm going to be a guest speaker as well. We should tell everybody a little bit about that as well, Ken.
Yeah, in May on the Canadian Long Weekend, KOAC, which is Canadian Association of Aquarium Clubs, is holding their annual convention. It's hosted by the London Aquarium Society this year, and it's in London, Ontario. For anyone who doesn't know where London is, it's about 2 hours east of Detroit. So that gives you kind of a rough idea where it is. And it's shaping up to be a fantastic weekend as well. Again, Ken's going to be one of the speakers there. And we'll have some of yous out there, mm-hmm. so you can have a look at that. And overall, a great lineup of speakers.
I'm looking forward to doing my talk for our listeners out there. It's going to be the evolution of the killifish family. And I'll be taking everybody back into the Triassic and Jurassic periods as we find the beginning is that one of my favorite families of fishes. But you can also meet and greet with me there for those who look forward to that. I'm looking forward to meeting everybody and saying hi and talking. We can talk about all kinds of subjects, Ken. I know from paleontology. Well, if our listeners, Ken and me on the show here, we talk about all kinds of stuff in nature. So you can talk with us there. Also, Ken, we need to mention that our partner in crime on Tank Topics, Ron Bishop, is also going to be there with us. He's the president of KOAC, I believe, isn't he?
He's the president of KOAC as well as the president of the London Aquarium Society.
And he's our co-host on Tank Topics.
He'll be there front and center. And a co-host, as Ken says, on Tank Topics. So come alongside all of us. And if you've got any suggestions, again, if you happen to be this way, drop by. Say hello and let us know what you think of the show.
Yeah, and if any of our listeners are there and you have fossils or something that you'd like to have me try to identify for you, I'll be there. I'll be able to do that for you as well. I just thought about that, Ken. That's one of my things I do for people is help identify things they've found, you know. So we want to – oh, and one more quick show announcement here, too, as for listeners. I'm also going to be on the American Long Weekend, our Memorial Day. I'm going to be in Denver, Colorado, at the American Killifish Association National Convention, where I'll be a guest speaker as well. And that's going to be a tight weekend for me. You'll be there with you guys in the weekend before and Denver the following weekend.
It'll be a busy week for you.
Going to be traveling all over, but you can stop in and visit. Excuse me, that frog always shows up right about now. You know? But you can visit with me there as well, and I'll be hanging out with all my killifish friends. I'll be doing, as I mentioned, a lecture on Saturday, the evolution of the killifish family for those folks as well. Plus, I'll have artwork there available. And this year, I've been commissioned by the American Killifish Association. I'm working on the awards for our listeners out there. The first place paintings have already been completed for the plaques. They're going to be nice and great plaques, and with a walnut backing, they're beautiful. And I'm looking forward. I'm proud to be able to do the awards once again for the AKA. So that's our show announcements here coming up. And we'll remind you after the show, too, before we close. Ken, we've got a really great show tonight, I think. You know, we're going to go back to one of our areas that we've covered quite a bit. And it's actually because I live in the area. And that's the western edge of Pangaea.
And it's an exciting topic tonight, too. I think it's a section that we haven't talked about before, to my knowledge. Not specifically. We have discussed some aspects of it, but not in depth, have we?
No, this is the we've glossed over some of the Carboniferous stuff, but tonight we're going to target a specific area here on the western edge of Pangaea. We're going to be looking at what's called the Pennsylvania Sandia Formation. It's an interesting formation. Its age is close to Atokan, which is in the middle Pennsylvanian period, towards the beginning of the middle Pennsylvanian, the Muscovian sequence. And it represents a really interesting series, a sequence of events that was happening here, Ken. New Mexico, where this takes place, I live just south of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And we were just a little bit north of the equator back in the Carboniferous period, real close to the equator. But this area here was dominated by a series of ancestral Rocky Mountain orogenies that started back probably as early as the Devonian period, were continuing into the lower Carboniferous or Mississippian period. And here in the Atokan, at the beginning of the middle Carboniferous, middle Pennsylvanian period, these mountains or these islands were on the rise. There was tectonic upheavals as parts of Pangaea were coming together. We see as we go south, there was I forget the name of the plate that was sinking below the Pangaean plate. But one of the plates was subducting at the time, and it was helping to cause these orogenies to appear. And we'll talk a little bit about those here in a minute. But it was a real interesting time, Ken, because these islands, basically, you know, were showing some interesting life forms, interesting. They were the deposit records some interesting happenings here on the Western Edge, not only from we can say fully terrestrial parts of the Sandia Formation to fully marine. So we get got quite a bit of stuff happening right in this one particular period of time.
Whereabouts are we talking about with the Sandia, Ken? Did you say the Muscovian?
Yeah, I believe we're talking about 340 to 345 million years ago, thereabouts.
Okay, how is that in relation to Roma's Gap?
To our which what?
To Roma's Gap?
It was a little bit after.
After the Gap, okay.
Yeah, just a little bit after. Roma's Gap, for the most part, occurred during the earliest part of the Mississippian. And it, I guess it took up close to 20 million years. So when we look at that, that's approximately about 360 million to 300, and well, actually about 340 million years. We see this, it looks like part of the Roma's Gap does enclose part of the Atokan.
Right. So I just needed to get that straight in my head.
Yeah, now I'm looking at this.
The gap. Yeah.
And now it's interesting because when we're looking here at the fossils here that we do find in the Sandia Formation here in New Mexico, for the most part, we have a really nice sequence of marine things. Now, let me talk. Let's talk a little bit about as we look at the deposits of the Sandia Formation. They range in thickness. Let's see here. How thick are they? I think they go from. Oh my goodness! I hate it when I do this, Ken. When I've got the notes right in front of me and I can't even see it. I think my eyes are going crossed or something. I'll get it here in just a second. But at any rate, the Sandia Formation runs from the north to south. It has several outcroppings here throughout central New Mexico. And but as we look at the deposition of it, what we see are in parts of it fully terrestrial deposits. And these deposits now are along the different uplifts. We have the Pedernal, the Zuni Defiance, the Uncompahgre, I believe there was a, what's the one, the Hoyta Hill uplift. And these were areas that the basement granite rocks were rising up above the sea. We can understand this because when we look at these rocks, we don't see, for the most part, they have the Sandia Formation directly on the Great Basement. Now, we do have a couple areas, Ken, where the Mississippian is recorded on the basement rocks. So it appears that there was a Mississippian sequence. Then we have a hiatus of the rest of the Mississippian period, Roma's Gap, have you, that is not recorded here. Because we see the basement rock and all the Mississippian and everything, you know, is eroded off. Then we have this Mississippian rock being deposited directly on the Precambrian granites. Now, these granites are cool because these are cratonic granites. They're we're close to 1.8 billion years old or older. And now that's young for granite, but it's still old.
Right.
Now,
yeah.
Now let's go back in time a little bit to the Precambrian, Ken. What say you?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go back to about 1.8 to 1.2 billion years ago. And
right.
these granites, interestingly enough, when we're I wish I had had you here. Because I'm to use the point of reference here, when you for those who know a little bit about New Mexico, I live about 20 miles south of Albuquerque, and I live directly west of what's called the Manzanita Mountains, about 5 miles west of the Manzanitas. Now, the Manzanita Mountains are interesting because the Manzanita Mountains are about 1.2 to 1.5 billion year old quartzites. And Ken, there's almost a mile thick deposit of these quartzites too. We're talking, you know, real thick deposit. Now, when you go up north to the 20 miles to the Sandia Mountains, where just by Albuquerque, the basal rocks are granites. Those are the basal granites. So what we have is these granites of the 1.8 billion years ago were shedding clasts into the sea along this area because these quartzites are actually Precambrian beach sands that were deposited along the seashore along these earliest orogenies.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty cool, you know. So when we look at other periods here, as we start looking through time, you know, like I said, we see these beach sands. There's 2 billion years ago is more than enough time for the pressure of deposits over them to crystallize it into quartzites. And because quartzite is basically modified beach sands. Now, when we start looking into the earliest deposits, this is what's really cool. We, as we're looking at the Sandia granites, and we're looking at the Manzano Mountain quartzites, we see that the earliest deposits of the Sandia Formation, and now it was deposited on a what's called a paleo-relief surface, which means that rivers and things were cut into these granites and into these quartzites. And these quartzites and granites here were being eroded, and we see those rock fragments at the very base of the Sandia Formation. So we know we can see what the was being eroded, you know, for these earliest deposits to start being laid down. That's so cool, you know.
It is, actually.
Yeah. And like I said, if you was walking on the what was exposed before the Sandia Formation, you'd be walking up and down hills in the granite, you know, just like it was a regular, like an island. It would have been an island, you know, a granite island here because the Sandia Mountains are part of the Pedernal Uplift on the very western edge of it. So, and what's really cool is we start looking now at the sand deposits as we start getting up into it, because in some places it's over 160 feet thick down by the Manzano Mountains, the southern Manzano Mountains. And we'll talk a little bit about that area because I've explored that several times. But as we see these clasts, you know, being deposited, we look around in the Sandia Formation, we see some areas where that had the typical terrestrial type of deposits, where they had the soils, the stream channels showing the streams running off the uplifts. Other places, we even see evidence of swamps that were along the coast line of these uplifts. And as we move out away from the uplifts themselves now, we start getting into where we start seeing beach sands because we see a change in architecture of the sandstones, and I'll explain that in a second, Ken. And then as we get further out away from the uplifts, we start getting into deeper water, we start getting into black and green shale deposits.
What course is that, Ken?
Usually the water's kind of stagnant, and it's higher in organic material. And because the it's a little bit calmer as we get away from the the wave shore, because when we look at the nearshore deposits, like the sandstones there, they show that they've been really hit hard by waves, you know, storm waves and stuff like that.
Right.
And as we get further out into the calmer weather or the calmer sea, the area where the water's deeper, the sediments settle out and the finer sediments start settling out. And because these bays or these embayments appear to be kind of starved a little bit. They didn't get a real good circulation like in the deeper waters. So we see this a lot of organic material. Now, one of the interesting things about this shale is when we look at the southern Manzano Mountains there, the Abo Pass area, that's for our listeners that keep up with some of our talks. The shale there is blackish to blackish green and extremely crumbly. I mean, where you just cannot look for fossils in a can. It's just nothing.
But it still qualifies as shale.
It is shale, yeah. It's laid down into fine layers, but it weathers and just weathers to pieces. And this is one of the lowermost layers, too. But down in Abo Pass, we're looking at, we were probably around 10 to 15, maybe 20 miles off of the edge of the Pedernal uplift. So we're seeing the shore, the sediments. Now, we do see as we get closer to the quartzites of the uplift, we'll see a little bit more plant fossils. We see lepidodendron, we see calamites, fern fossils, and as we get up towards like the Sandia Mountains, where it originally rests on the Precambrian basement, that's where we see a lot of these real nice plant fossils that can be recovered, actually.
That's one thing we haven't much talked about very much, is it? The plant fossils. We've mainly talked about the animals that you've found.
Yeah, and this here particular deposit does have some interesting plants in it. It does show that these islands, were back at this point in time, were actually, covered with plant life. I imagine they had some interesting animal life. Now, the oldest vertebrate fossil, terrestrial vertebrate fossil here in New Mexico, comes from the Sandia Formation up in just a little bit north of here. It comes from, I believe, an area called the Rancho de Chaparral, which is just north of the Nacimiento Mountains, up real close to the Jemez Caldera. And the Jemez Caldera is one of the largest volcanic features on the Earth. Ken, you and I will have to do some volcanics here one of these days and talk about some of these volcanic features, because they can be very interesting.
Sure. That sounds like a good idea, actually.
Yeah.
Worldwide, aren't they?
Well, the Ring of Fire.
Obviously. Yeah.
And there's some interesting stuff about volcanoes in the past that we'll have to talk about. That actually would be a good show, Volcano, because it's they've caused some interesting things in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Anyway, the oldest vertebrate fossil, it's found in some deposits that appeared possibly to have come off. I'm trying to think what this. There was a little uplift, and unfortunately, we don't see the uplift mentioned, I think, here in this particular my notes here. But anyway, there was this a small uplift just kind of bordering the Uncompahgre uplift to the north here, one of the parts of the early Rocky Mountain orogeny. Now, the Uncompahgre uplift was a good-sized island. It took up a part of northern New Mexico and a chunk of southern Colorado. The Zuni, the Pedernal uplift that we mentioned quite a bit when we talk about this part of Pangaea, was actually an island that was maybe 40, 50 miles wide and maybe 150 or so miles long, and it was situated fully inside the state of what was to become the state of New Mexico. And to the west of it, covering Texas, was Inland Sea. That particular point in time, see now, back in this particular period of time, Ken, I believe amphibians were the dominant terrestrial form. I don't think the fully amniote egg had really gotten going yet at this particular period of time.
They hadn't. Okay.
Yeah, they were talking, just right, still back in the, early in the you know, fairly early in the Carboniferous. But now here's one of the things I like to mention about this particular period of time is when I'm looking at fossils, and we've mentioned this on the show in the past about a ghost lineage of animals. But when I'm looking at the terrestrial fossils, and we look at the what are full amphibian fossils, and we see an anomaly in their the monas. In the amniotes, we have a 5-digit monas, and in the amphibians, we have a 4-digit monas. That means front foot. And Ken, I believe back early in the evolution, right as, you know, we start finding the very first truly what we know as an amphibian, I would have to imagine that if we look somewhere maybe a million or so years around that area, we're not only, what I believe we should find is a 5-toed amphibian. The 5-toed lineage. It should be, you know, the 4-toed should have broke off from a 5-toed lineage. You know, when it seems like in evolution, when you lose a feature like bones and toes and limbs and stuff, that feature's lost. You don't gain it. It takes a special kind of condition, you know, like the replication of a Hox gene. And
right.
I find our
but,
5 digits.
But you think it might be lost in Roman's gap somewhere?
I think, yeah, I think what happens, we have, as we look back at like the Tiktaalik, Pandarichthys, and we see, the loss of digits. I think it was Tiktaalik had the 8 toes on the front, you know. And as these animals are becoming more and more terrestrially adapted, you know, these too many toes were probably in the way, you know. So we see an adaption, you know, a loss of digits here. And the 5-toed digit, when you reach that lineage, you know, that lineage did not really truly die out. It became us, you know. And for off that line, I say there's somewhere we should be able to, if we get lucky, to find, before we find the 4-toed fossil amphibian, we should find a 5-toed fossil amphibian that's just a little bit older than that. And possibly
you're just gonna have to go out there and prove that hypothesis again.
Yeah, it's. But I think that's possibly a line, because I was looking at an Eriops of fossils, and they have 5 toes on the front. And when you look at some like the Limnocephalus, Didactes, these were called amphibiomorphs or reptilomorphs. You know, and they're thought to be amphibians or an old lineage, you know, the oldest amniotes. But they're big animals. We're talking big animals. So their ancestors had to evolve a lot before that, because the earliest amniotes we see, for our listeners out there, an amniote means the egg-bearing, like lizards and reptiles, the hard-shelled ones. When we find our first amniotes, you know, they're little guys, and they have five digits on the toes. And I don't know. I just see that particular lineage evolving, you know, from a 5-toed lineage. So for our young paleontologists out there, go out there and try to figure that out. Look at where some of these older animals are found. For those of us in paleontology, we think Romer's Gap is more or less just needing people to go out there and do the research. You know, we need foot leather or shoe leather, I guess.
There are pieces of the so-called gap being filled in all the time, aren't there?
That there are. You know, we're finding, and it does appear to be, you know, that just getting out there and finding these areas, and as we're able to piece more and more of the ancient land forms, Ken, you know. It's like as what we're talking about tonight, you know. I know where to target now here in this particular period of time to go look for some of these animals that got isolated on these islands. You know, we're looking at island evolution here on these uplifts. Now, that's really, really fascinating, I think.
It is, actually. Very. How long were they islands, in fact?
Well, these were islands probably throughout most of the Carboniferous up until we start getting towards the end of the Carboniferous, and then we start, and especially into the Permian. Because when we get into the Permian, you know,
mm-hmm.
we start getting the bursum and abo formations, and
right.
during the bursum, we start seeing the terrestrial deposits connecting these islands, and that's, of course, is when I believe Dimetrodon evolution happened. But here
that's
we're looking, you know,
long enough for animals to speciate.
Oh, absolutely,
mm-hmm.
definitely. And when we're looking at on these islands here now, most the synapses hadn't really evolved yet. They didn't start evolving up until the later part of the Permian. And interestingly enough, after the basal reptile, the synapsid lineage. Because it's interesting when we look at the skulls on the tetrapods, kind of like as they become more evolved, they lose or gain more openings in their skull. When we look at the basal amniote, they have what's called an anapsid skull. They don't have any openings in their skulls. And then the first evolutionary trend we see are the synapsid skull with the single opening. And these, of course, evolved into the therapsids and the mammals. Now, the next lineage we see is called a diapsid skull, where we see this lineage evolve two openings in their skull. Now, these openings are behind the eyes for our
mm-hmm.
listeners. And these two openings denote modern-day reptiles like lizards. What's that?
What are the openings for?
Lightening the skull, I would guess. And sometimes they allow muscle attachment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ours appears to be for a muscle attachment that allows us to have strong jaws to bite with. And,
okay.
Yeah. And then, of course, when we do look at the next evolutionary trend, is we start seeing the evolution of the diapsid skull into the dinosaur skull with the one opening in front of the eyes. And it's interesting that we see this here in the fossil record. You know, we follow these same openings. But one of the things that we're going to try to do here over the next summer here, Ken, is
mm-hmm.
I'm going to try to start working into these terrestrial deposits here in central New Mexico on the Sandia Formation. Because, as I mentioned, I was kind of got myself sidetracked. But up at an area called Rancho de Chaparral, which is north of Albuquerque by about a 50-mile drive, 50 miles, I believe, the deposits up there produced the bones of an amphibian. I believe it's Greer Erpaton is what it was identified at, which is a long, slender amphibian. And here's kind of an interesting thing, Ken.
Mm-hmm.
Was Greer Erpaton actually has quite a wide range. And I wonder, you know, because there was a good paper, and you and I brought it up on one of our earlier shows about the evolution of tetrapods. Was it a marine origin or a freshwater origin? And when we look at modern animals that fish that are invading the land, like the mudskippers and stuff, they come from a marine environment for the most part. We do have the
right.
Tetapoma climbing perch, but it's been hypothesized that a lot of these early amphibians, like Greer Erpaton and et cetera, were possibly salt tolerant. They could actually, because if that's the hypothesis is true, that tetrapods did evolve along the coastline, back in the Devonian. These earlier amphibians would probably retain a salt tolerance, you know, until it evolved out of them.
That would make sense, wouldn't it?
I kind of agree with that hypothesis. I can understand that, because one of the things that we see is that, like in modern day, if a fish would have, it was hypothesized, you know, that fish grew legs, basically, you know, evolved these legs to move from a drying pond into a wetter pond. But as it was pointed out in that particular paper, it's drier outside the drying pool than it is, you know, in the pool. And modern fishes never leave a drying pool because they would die, you know. And the only time a modern fish will leave a pool of water and actually get out on land is during wet season, when it's rainy, usually. It's wet. And, you know, that's when we see the climbing perch, you know. It's able to keep wet, you know, and do its thing. What's that catfish, walking catfish?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll come out on rainy, you know, rainy periods. Even, okay, I believe, the snakeheads. Some of those species have been known, I think, to come out on land, when it's wet, and explore around the edges of things. And it's interesting watching these fish do that.
Well, there's even a little killifish that kind of lives on land, isn't there?
Isn't that amazing? There's actually a killifish that is more amphibian than it is killifish. That's the little Cryptorhynchus marmoratus, the mangrove killifish that lives around the Caribbean area. I think Central America, Mexico, parts of the United States even, and a couple of the Caribbean islands, I think, actually. But, Ken, these things have been found in water-soaked logs. You break open a log and you'll find dozens of them.
I heard that, actually, yeah. It's quite amazing.
Well, I remember when they were first discovered, and they thought that, but for the most part, they lived down in the little holes and burrows and stuff dug by, crabs and et cetera, you know, around mangroves and stuff. But it was found that that was actually the stray, and they find these things now thick in these wet areas. And it's interesting, too, because they found some other interesting things about some of these killifish. It appears that some of these actually do come out of a pool and will lay along the wet leaf litter in some of these areas, some of the rivulets. And I think there's even a couple annual killifishes that are reported to do that. And kind of fascinating. You know, they'll find them at night in the water where they go back into the water to spawn in these areas.
Well, if it works, you might as well utilize it.
That's what's so fantastic about evolution, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's
just
a habitat.
Just when you think you know it all, something like that happens.
Yeah, and it's like, I'll be darned. You got to reset your thinking on a lot of things, you know. And that's what's fun about all this new stuff is when I'm looking at these islands, you know, and trying to imagine, you know, what was evolving then. Now, there was some other cool, interesting things that was happening back then, too. You know, we don't talk about a lot about the weather back then, but we were seeing some interesting things happening. One thing I think a lot of people, when you start talking paleontology to them, is they don't realize that the days, as we go further and further back in the past, we're shorter and shorter because that Earth was spinning faster and faster. Back in the Devonian, there was around 400 days in a year. Were you aware of that?
No, I wasn't, actually.
And it's interesting how we know this, Ken. We look at the solitary corals that were growing back then, and what appears to be the year-annual growth rates, there's approximately 400 days, 400 growth rings inside each of those annual rings on these corals.
Wow.
Yeah. So they record the daily growth and approximately, you know, back in the Carboniferous, days were about 22 and a half hours long as opposed to the 24 they are today.
So if you go back further, it would be longer? The year would be longer?
They can actually get shorter.
Well, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
If you go back further, would it be shorter again?
Oh yeah, I imagine when Earth probably first formed, we were probably seeing 10-hour days.
Wow.
Yeah, it's probably spinning real fast, you know. And because one of the things that has helped slow it down has been the tidal effect of the seas and oceans, and also the tidal mm-hmm. effect of the moon.
Right.
Yeah, and that's kind of has helped slow it down. So we need to. And now, one of the interesting things too, it's been seems to been noted is that because the Earth was spinning faster, the Coriolis effect was actually a little bit working a little bit faster, and the winds were estimated to be a little bit higher as well. So when we're looking here at these islands, now we're looking here on the west side of Pangaea, just coming straight off the sea, you know, and this would have been in the tropics, down by the equator back then too. So that's probably why we see some of the rock, the rock deposits like we have here. When we look at the along the edge of the Pedernal in the Sandia Formation, we actually see large rocks, that were being beaten off the Pedernal uplift.
It's pretty amazing that you can work all these things out just by looking at the fossils, isn't it?
Excuse me?
It's pretty amazing that you can work all, like, the climate and the length of the day, and et cetera, out just by observing the growth rate of some of the fossil organisms, isn't it?
It is fascinating about that, Ken. And here's another really cool thing. Is when we look in also into where some of these organisms were laid down, certain isotopes were recorded in their bodies when they died, and sometimes these isotopes don't weather out of the, like in brachiopods. These isotopes in the shell stay there because the shell is made out of carbonate, calcium carbonate. And the interesting thing, it can tell you basically whether it was warm water or cool water where these things lived, because we can compare their isotope levels with modern organisms that live in cool water or warm water, and we see that, like, oxygen is one of the isotopes that we're able to use, and we can are able to infer, you know, where these where they lived. We can look at bones of dinosaurs and look at some of the chemicals in them and find out what, you know, they were feeding on and stuff. I mean, it's these bones and stuff and these fossil shells are really telling us a lot about, you know, what was going on in the past.
Ken?
Yes.
Ken Borman? Okay. I'm making sure you both are there. All right.
I did drop momentarily, Ken.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
I didn't even know.
Yeah.
So, okay, where were we?
I'm sorry about that. I apologize to all our listeners. For some reason, my connection dropped out.
That's what's so fun about live radio.
Oh, yes. It is. It's much fun.
Oh, I change the subject here a little bit and kind of go off here, but here in New Mexico, one of the reasons I liked moving to Mexico was because it was like the old wild, wild west. And if the wind blows a little bit too hard, we lose our phone service. If it gets damp, we lose our phone service.
That aspect of it isn't all that good, is it?
Oh, it happens way too much. I mean, I'm so aggravated here with it out here for that there. I'm thinking about taking up smoke signals, you know. Might be more... go old style for this area, you know. But now here's an interesting thing, though. Let's get back to this particular point in time. Now,
mm-hmm.
as we look back east, the part of Pangaea, we see spatially south of where you're at, Ken. There, and the state of Pennsylvania, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that area, well, even as far west as Illinois, Indiana, parts of Kentucky, that part was just west as the Earth was tilted a little bit, or the I guess the continents were tilted a little bit. So that part of the continent was almost directly west of where I'm at, so it was tropical. And we
right.
see the buildup of a lot of coal forest measures, you know. Hundreds of feet thick and stuff, and just big coal forest measures. But here on the west coast, we did not have that. We do find a little bit of a swampland. We'll find tropical plants from this particular time. A lot of the spore-bearing plants, ferns, were really one of the most common fossils, actually, Ken, that we find here in the Sandia Formation. That and some of the early seed ferns.
And we've done shows about them. They were very prolific in back in the day, weren't they?
They were the dominant forms. And now it's interesting, too, because when we see the evolution of the what we call the seed ferns, which were basically the first seed plants, they form seeds. And these seeds were kind of like the hard-shelled eggs of the reptiles, you know, and it allowed these particular plants to start colonizing other areas. And also close to the same time that we see the evolution here in the Carboniferous of the peltosperms, we'll call them seed ferns, peltosperms, we also have the evolution of the conifers. And throughout the Carboniferous here, we start seeing walking-type conifers appearing not much long after we see this particular point in time here in the New Mexico fossil record. And walkian conifers are a primitive type of conifer tree. For our listeners out there, to give you a good example of what a walkian conifer looked like, and they dominated the landscapes out here. These islands were probably covered with these peltosperms and these conifers. But they look like the modern Norfolk pine. You got a Norfolk pine, you've got a real good representative conifer of a one of these early walking types.
Quite an attractive plant, that, too.
What's that?
They're quite an attractive plant, too.
That they are. I think they're beautiful, you know. One of my favorite of the conifers. Now, when it comes to fossils here, a lot of these plant fossils we do find are pretty beat up. So we know that they were and a lot of them, Ken, too, are also in just the offshore marine deposits. That's something that's kind of interesting. So we are getting a little bit of glimpse of this life here that was being washed out into the surrounding sea.
Actually, Ken, a question just came to mind. Do you ever get fossils of aquatic plants, things that are very obviously aquatic plants?
You know, I think the only closest thing that we've come ourselves in finding that are the carbonate algae that we see in the reefs out here of the Carboniferous reefs. I have not found what I would say is a fully aquatic plant.
They should have been around then, shouldn't they?
Yeah, because the land plants came from aquatic plants.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That's another gap.
Another gap, yeah. Well, that's the thing about fossil formation. It's fickle. You know, so, but once again, it just takes getting out there and looking for these torn up pages, you know, that were scattered all over the planet, you know, with the fossils. Because some areas you have that were always an erosional surface, and when you have an erosional surface, you may have Tyrannosaurus rexes climbing all over it. But if those bones don't get buried, you're not going to find those T rexes. You know, you're only going to find that stuff where things get buried. And back in your area, Ken, there was dinosaurs in the Cretaceous climbing all over that area, but none of the fossils got fossilized. So,
right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's funny when you think about it. You know. Yeah, and it's kind of fascinating. You know, it's like, wow, it was really an amazing time. But once again here, like I said, when we're looking at this particular pod, boy, time, here it is. Look at the time, Ken. I just, every show, guys, out there, Ken and I start this show. It started 5 minutes ago for me. Here it is, almost the end of the hour, and it's like, wow. These things are just so fun to talk about, and I hope you, our listeners out there, enjoy, you know, talking, you know, hearing about this. I know we sometimes go a little bit off subject, or I get to going, but
that's all right. We usually come back to it.
yeah, but once again, like I said, this is a very interesting transition, because what happened right after this particular point in time, Ken, is that it turned fully marine here in this particular area. These Sandia deposits, even the terrestrial ones, were covered over by marine sequences. Now we still had our Pedernal uplift and our Zuni Defiance uplift and our Uncompahgre uplift, but they were depositing, once again, we see their nearshore deposits as we look around the limestones and stuff. To give you a good idea of what was going on, now, when we look here at the Sandia formation here, Ken, when we start going up in the time and we get to about 310 million years ago, we're talking 30 million years later, that's when we have the Kenny Brick Quarry here on the edge of the Pedernal. So we have 30 million years worth of evolution going on here between these things, you know? And
that's a lot of evolution, isn't it?
Yeah, that is. And so we're going to end up, we'll have to do another show and talk about what was going on during that particular period of time as well, because there was 30 million years is a lot of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But anyway, the Sandia formation, as I said, it's a very interesting formation. It has some very interesting life in it. One of the things about it, and it hasn't been researched very much, and I know Dr. Lucas here at the museum wants me to get on it. He mentioned several years ago about a lower Pennsylvanian sequence that he wants my brother and I to look at, because he believes we will be the ones that will find the fossil bones in it. And there's so far only one spot's been found with bone, and the rest is just waiting, I guess, for me to go there and see what I can find.
Right. Actually, you mentioned Dr. Lucas. He would have to be regarded as like one of the foremost experts on New Mexican paleontology, wouldn't he, Ken?
Dr. Spencer Lucas is. He's I find him just a fascinating man, and I love working with him. And him and I can joke about things, but I did get to show him up, though, Ken. I really did, and it was a doozy.
Isn't it great when you can do that?
Oh, well, this was funny. It's been a while since I've told this tale for our listeners out there. Sometimes, you know, when you're a kid, one of the things I like about paleontology and fossil hunter stuff, most of us, we still keep the kid in us. The kid, that young kid that's got the bright eyes when you're seeing stuff, you know, that's who we are. I get so upset when I see people out there that look at us like we're the crazy people, you know, to be ignored and stuff. You know, there's some religions out there that think we're just bad people. It's like, guys, we're just kids interested in what's happening around us, you know, interested in our world. We're not devils or possessed or anything. So mm-hmm. We're these kids. So at any rate, the kid in me always wanted to find a very spectacular fossil site, you know, and you always hope. So at any rate, my brother and I got permission several years ago to go collecting in the central New Mexico Abel Formation in the Abel Pass area. And one of the places we wanted to go and look at, it was in fossil rock collecting books, was a place called the Abel Copper Mine. I call it the Sholey Copper Mine because that's the true name of it. Mm-hmm. And it was known for many years as a plant site. You could find petrified plant that's been mineralized with azurite and malachite. That's what I was trying to think. And it was a channel deposit that was well studied for many years, even back in the 40s. It was an open pit copper mine. There were some shafts dug, a whole bunch of history going into it. But anyway, I got permission from the landowner to go out to the Sholey copper mine and hunt fossils. And this is funny because I'd been to the copper mine once before, but we didn't have permission. And I get worried about, I do not like to trespass. It's one thing I just cannot do. I have to have permission from a landowner. So we were there about 5 minutes. I said, come on, let's go. I can't do this. So we didn't find anything at all. But once we got permission, Ken, every time we've got permission from one of these landowners, we find stuff because we're relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
So we go out there, we hike around the copper mine, then we took a big old hike up and around the area, and my brother found a neural spine of a Dimetrodon, first fossil we found. And that was, really cool to find that. So that got us in as researchers at the museum by finding that Dimetrodon. But as we went back towards the mine itself, I found a little toe bone fossil there in the where the old gravel driveway kind of thing was between the old mill parts. So I took that in and showed it to Lucas, and he said, no. He goes, it doesn't matter. He goes, we've been out there. You can't put that into context. It doesn't matter, where it comes from. So I thought, tell me I can't put this in context. So my brother and I, we went back out to the mine. I got to thinking about it. I said, I bet you it's in that open pit. So my brother, I sent him. He wanted to go find some of the copperized petrified wood, and I wanted to go over to find that bone. So I go over, and I start looking around the rock, and I start seeing fossil bone everywhere in this rock. Now, this is Lower Permian period, Abbo Formation, about 397-million-year-old rock, 398 million years old. So I start looking, and I found a rock right there sticking out of the matrix with a bone sticking out of it. And I was able to pick this bone up. And anyway, I took it in and showed it to Dr. Lucas. He wanted to know if we could take him back to where I found it. Took him back to Sholey Copper Mine, and he was stunned because he'd been standing there in the middle of the copper mine, and he did not see the bone.
you gotta have the eye, don't you? And you gotta
have the eye, Yeah, and the bone showed
you
up.
You do have to expect to see it, I think, as well.
I think they were blinded by the minerals.
Right.
Because when you looked at some of the rock with the bone in it, it almost appeared to be feldspars, except there's so much of it. And some of the bone that we, rock that we found, sandstone there, I've found, so far I've identified 6 bone layers with continued research. We just went out there a few weeks ago. We collected more bone, and I actually found some Dimetrodon parts. So we was real happy about that, too. So, yeah, and we're even thinking about maybe doing a little research tomorrow. There's some Abbo Formation up north that we're wanting to go and check out. So, actually, Ken, I might be out in the field tomorrow.
I wish I was with you, Ken.
You got to come out here and go with me. You really do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, like I said, I got so many places to take you. I'll guarantee you finding bone. We'll try to take. I can get you dinosaur bone. We'll get you Dimetrodon fossils. We can go clicking at one of the most important Pennsylvanian marine fossil sites in the world. We'll go to the Kelly Mine.
One day I will get there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm making it there. For our listeners here, as we're getting towards the end of the show here, we need to mention this real quick. Ken, you and I got some, both of us got some shows coming up here in the next couple months that we're going to be attending.
Certainly do. Mine's the first one, I guess, in a couple of weeks. If anyone is out in Connecticut, Tom, Mary, and myself will be at the Northeast Council of the Aquarian Society's 41st Annual Convention on the weekend of April 8th to the 10th at Rocky Hill, Connecticut. I've got 14 speaker programs. I've got vendor and manufacturing halls, sales. A whole floor is going to be devoted to room sales, for hobbyists, bred livestock. So there's always plenty. You've mentioned in the past that when you were there, Ken, someone was even selling orchids, I believe.
Yes. Yes, even orchids. Frogs.
So who knows what you'll be able to find there. Come along and have a look. Say good day to us. I'm always up for a chat. And If you've got any suggestions for the show, for any programs you want us to do, let us know. Come out and say hello, and we'll be very pleased to talk to you. So with that, we've got the raffles of Ken's artwork coming up. All the details are at naturestalkshow.com. Have a look at what's coming up, and believe me, it's going to be a great weekend. It's a great hotel. It's newly renovated, and it's got I'm speaking from the blurb now, but it's got exquisite guest rooms and amenities, so it should be great.
And the people there are wonderful. You know, they made me feel right at home. And as I mentioned, you know, you go to a show, these shows are a blast, Ken. You and I have been to many different shows over the years, you know, and it's like a family reunion. You meet new friends, you get with old friends, you know, and it's just a fantastic time. You come home with wonderful fish, you know. When I show up, people can get artwork from me. Matter of fact, when they go to that show there in Connecticut, you're going to have some artwork that we're raffling off for our minds to help support our show. So, when our
certainly
people
are.
Check that out.
And some of them are paleontological as well, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm known for my prehistoric reproductions, and I've donated a couple lobe fins from that we talked about on one of our fine art of paleontologists in the past. These were fishes that were used to illustrate that show. And you've got the original artworks in your hand, I believe.
I certainly do. I'm buying some tickets in them myself.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm probably not allowed to win them.
Oh, I forgot them. Back up in Canada. Doggone it. Oh, man. Yeah, and then you and I are going to be together at the KOAC show in May. We'll be hanging out and signing autographs and talking and laughing and sharing stories and everything with people. So we want them to stop in at that show there, and that's going to be in around the 20th of May in London, Ontario, I believe. Right, Ken?
Yes, it is. It's the Victoria Day long weekend here in Canada. It's the week before your long weekend in the States. I can't remember what yours is for, Ken. What is yours? Is it Columbus?
Ours is Memorial Day. It's
Memorial Day.
For memory of all the soldiers in the past that have served America.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, this will be the week before Memorial Day. If you're anywhere up near London, Ontario, it's only 2 hours, east of Detroit. I said west before, I think. I meant east. So it's not very far from the border. So come on over, and you can talk to the whole crew from Tank Topics.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Bishop, of course, will be there as the president of both KOAC and the London Aquarium Society, who are hosting that convention.
Yeah, and if you're going to be up in Denver, Colorado way, the following weekend, Memorial Day weekend, I'm going to be at the American Killifish Association National Convention as well. So you will be able to catch me in a couple of spots here right at the end of May. And I'll probably be so tired after those, Ken, I probably won't come out for a month or so.
And, you have to go into hyphen action, Ken.
All right. And I don't have my notes with me in front, but to remind everybody what to do about the show, that we need to go to Blog Talk Radio, www.blogtalk.com/NaturesTalkShow, or NTS. Click on the follow button for us. We appreciate that. We want you to go to Nature's Talk Show website as well. And as Ken mentioned, we have the artwork on raffle. I think you can probably buy raffle tickets over the website, can't you, Ken?
I'm not sure if Tom's doing that or not.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to do some raffles over the web for our show. I'll put up some artwork and so we can keep the shows coming. But we, like I said, mentioned, check out our talk show. Check out our website. And go to our live chat room. We have all kinds of great stuff in our store that you can get to help support. You can go to our donate button or PayPal button and donate to the show as well. See, here we have the our newsletter. That's what I was trying to think of, Ken. My brain's on overload. So check out our newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, iTunes, and Facebook as well. Let's see, I believe that's it. Ken, you now get the next show announced here for our listeners here coming up. We'll talk about a couple subjects and everything. And next Sunday as well, we'll have a show for everybody.
Yeah, I sent you a message with a couple of ideas I've been picking around. So we'll talk about them. And as you say, we'll let our customers, our listeners know as soon as possible about the upcoming shows.
Thank you.
I'm still in sales mode from the past weekend.
I'm not the only one that can't tongue tied. I don't know who it's catching. Yeah.
I think it might have something to do with our age, Ken.
Don't say that. All right. Well, with that, Ken, once again, another wonderful trip into the past with you, Ken. I dig it. Like I said, this shows, once again, they go so fast.
They do.
Fastest hour on the planet for me. All right. Well, thanks, Ken. Thanks to our listeners for joining us tonight and everything. And join us the next time on Nature's Talk Show. Everybody have a wonderful, wonderful evening. Bye-bye.
Join us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.